The art and craft and business of writing come together in today's broadcast. After years of writing, living, working, and always writing, author Ceree Prince Halverson joins Rosemary Manchester in conversation about her just-released first published novel, The Underside of Joy, 16 languages and an audiobook in publication. Hi, I'm Suzanne Lang, and you are listening to A Novel Idea. During the second half of the show, I talk with author Sandy Baker, who is also part of the Redwood Writers and is the chairperson of the annual Redwood Writers Conference, to be held in Santa Rosa, California on April 28th. And Barbara Quick brings a perspective on Jeffrey Eugenides, the publishing establishment, and his novel, The Marriage Plot. Please stay with us. It's a novel idea. Set in the fictional town of Elbow on the fictional Redwood River, The Underside of Joy is Ceree Prince Halverson's love poem to Sonoma County. But it's also an emotional exploration into the life of a family that involves stepmoms and the children caught between them, the secrets hiding just beneath the surface within families, and ultimately the pain and love of being human. Let's begin the conversation between Rosemary and Ceree with Ceree reading the opening paragraphs of The Underside of Joy.
I recently read a study that claimed happy people aren't made. They're born. Happiness, the report pointed out, is all about genetics. A cheerful gene passed merrily down from one smiling generation to the next. I know enough about life to understand the old adage that one person can't make you happy or that money can't buy happiness. But I'm not buying this theory that your bliss can only be as deep as your gene pool. For 3 years, I did backflips in the deep end of happiness. The joy was palpable and often loud. Other times it softened. Zach's milky breath on my neck or Annie's hair entwined in my fingers as I braided it or Joe's humming some old Crowded House song in the shower while I brushed my teeth. The steam on the mirror blurred my vision, misted my reflection like a soft focus photograph smoothing out my wrinkles. But even those didn't bother me. You can't have crow's feet if you don't smile. And I smiled a lot. I also know now, years later, something else. The most genuine happiness cannot be so pure, so deep, or so blind.
You've been listening to a reading by Ceree Prince Halverson from her brand new book, which is called The Underside of Joy. And I'm thrilled to have you in the studio with me, Ceree.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you, Rosemary.
What a thrilling time in your life. Your book is just out. You're in the paper. You're all over the place. You're touring. You're talking about the book. You have book readings here and there. You've worked so long and hard for this. It must feel so gratifying.
It really does. I'm thrilled by the response I've been getting. And after so many years of having a handful of people read my work, to know that it's out there and that it's touching people has been more rewarding than I really could have imagined.
Well, writing is so solitary, and you spend all that time alone working on your writing, and then all of a sudden it must be like hatching out into a whole new world. Everyone wants to interview you, to talk to you, to find out how you did it.
This has been quite a milestone year for me. I turned 50. I have two sons and two stepdaughters, and they all flew the coop. And at the same time, a week after my son left for Italy, my novel sold. That happened a year ago in January, so it's been quite a year.
And, you know, people are celebrating with you. Maybe it happens a lot of places, but I always feel that in Sonoma County, that we celebrate each other's success. I just imagine writers all over Sonoma County, a kind of a fluttering of little wings saying, well, she made it. I'm going to keep trying. And maybe my book will be published as well.
I hope that this news is having that kind of effect, because that's what happened to me. A dear friend of mine, she was my writing sister for more than 15 years. We started in a writing group together. And several years ago, she got an amazing deal and sold her book. She had self-published it, and then New York caught on, and they published it, and it was published in 30 different countries. And she was my mentor in a lot of ways, and she passed away in June when all this was happening with my book. And no one was happier for her when her deal came through than I was. Her writing name was L. Newmark, and she wrote The Book of Unholy Mischief and The Sandalwood Tree, both gorgeous books. But she said, never, 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 never give up. She was always quoting Churchill. And that really rubbed off on me. And her success gave me hope that it could happen. And so that's what I'm hoping will happen to other writers. You know, the writing community is so supportive.
Yes.
It's amazing. I just find, you know, new writers and seasoned writers have been so encouraging and supportive. I'm really touched by it.
Yeah, it's wonderful to hear that. There is that kind of support and rejoicing in each other's success. And your senior editor at Dutton, Denise Roy, has this to say about. This is a quote from her letter. Editors who specialize in fiction count themselves fortunate to have an all-access pass to other lives, other places, sometimes other worlds entirely. She said the words of Cerie Prince Halverson instantly and powerfully reminded me that the best fiction allows the reader to see herself in a character and join her in waving goodbye en route to the journey forward. I find that the reading that I really get attached to is when I find myself identifying with the characters. And quite often when I go to a book club or when I'm talking about books, people tend to start out by saying, I really liked the book, or I really didn't like the book. And that's not the point. The point is, did the book engage you? And sometimes the books that engage me, I'm horrified at the experience that I'm about to go through with this author, but it's a tribute to the skill of the writer when the reader is just sucked right in and is engaged and looks up a few hours later and says, oh, it's over? What's she going to write next?
I completely agree. When I can identify with the character, even if it's someone who can be completely different than I am, a completely different situation, but the best writing, I think, helps us to walk in another's shoes, but also takes us along paths that we recognize and that we can say, that is how it felt for me.
Yes.
Even though this person's experience is completely different than mine. And so the best books, I think, make us feel less alone and more connected.
In your particular plot, I really enjoyed my time with Ella Bean, your protagonist. But before we get to Ella, there's a question I've been dying to ask you. Where did you learn to write like that?
You know, I don't have an MFA.
Right.
I thought about it. I wanted to get an MFA many times during the course of my life. From when I went to school, I studied journalism. My father was concerned about me making writing as a career, and he kept saying, you know, the only way a writer can really make a living is through advertising, writing advertising. And I quickly realized that what I really, truly wanted to do with my life was to write fiction and make things up. So I started taking workshops at the local community college, and I worked during the day as a copywriter and wrote marketing, and later, you know, was a creative director. And I soon started working freelance so that I could work around my kids and also have this fiction addiction that I had. So when work was slow, I would go back to the novel. It took me a lot of years, but this is actually my third finished novel with a couple others started. Mm-hmm. So I had some really close calls, but nothing ever came through until this one. So I was always writing, always taking workshops, and then later writing groups, always getting feedback from a small group of people.
Yes.
So many years of, I think I was on my in my own MFA program.
That's
what I really did. I read a lot of books. There's Stephen Koch, K-O-C-H, has a wonderful book. It's a workshop for a novelist or something like that that really has helped me quite a bit. And then, of course, the, you know, Annie Lamott's Bird by Bird and those things when you just need a friend. So yes, I think in some ways I earned an MFA on my own.
Yes, but your eloquence and your skill in writing is amazing. It's so admirable.
Thank you so much.
I always pick up so much more the second time through when I'm reading. The first time I'm reading for plot. What's going to happen? Mm-hmm. And, of course, your plot is riveting. And we're not going to give it away. No,
okay.
We never give away the plot. We're just tantalizing the readers out there.
Yeah, I like one of the things I like about Ella Bean is she's in this really serious, gut-wrenching situation, but she doesn't always take herself seriously, and she has a sense of humor even in the most dire circumstances. And I think that helped see her through and helped her help the kids through some of their pain was laughter. And, you know, laughter and pain are so interlinked, which, you know, hence the title of the book.
She's a wonderful character. She's so brave and innovative, and she never gives up.
She doesn't. In writing her story, I just kept learning more and more about her and how far she would go. And then she really needed to learn some things about herself as well. And when the time came for her to do that, she did gather her courage. And I'm talking carefully right now because I don't want to give away too much of the plot. But yes, I do think that she, in the end, she was brave, braver than she thought she was.
And you said that your first somewhere that your first vision of that you got of Ella Bean, she was under the blankets and didn't want to come out.
Yes, I saw this woman who was curled up in a bed under a blanket and feeling that she had once had everything and now that she'd ever wanted, and now she'd lost it. And I didn't know what her story was. I was originally trying to fit her into a story I had in my head going about a suffragette and the Iroquois.
Wow.
I know, and I still am thinking about that.
I want to read that one,
too. I do, too. Yes. I want to write that one, but... But Ella had a different story to tell.
Yes.
And I had that vision and about four other things that collided in my head. And then what happened, I was thinking about moms and stepmoms. I had recently become a stepmom. I had a stepmom. My kids had I had a stepmom. And the relationship between moms and stepmoms is, you know, in the very best situations, it can be uniting. This love that they both have for the same children. But it's also just full of insecurities and jealousies and the weird stuff we humans carry around with us. And so I really wanted to explore that. I mean, complex situation is, you know, it's a minefield. And for writers, minefield is another word for candy store. So I wanted to explore that. I also wanted to explore, I was thinking about women who, mothers who left their kids.
Yes.
And how in our society, that's really the unforgivable sin.
Yes.
And yet sometimes it is not a selfish act, but an act of sacrifice.
Yes.
But as a mom who was madly in love with my own children, I couldn't fathom it. I didn't understand it. Mm-hmm. And we write to understand. So I knew I had to write about that. Mm-hmm. And then I had recently moved back to Northern California and was madly in love, not only with my children, but with this area.
Yes.
And this book is definitely my love song, because I cannot sing, but my love song to Sonoma County. And I wanted to write about the beauty, and not just that we're in wine country, but all these other things, the redwoods and the ocean. And so I wanted to capture that. And then I walked into a little grocery store in Occidental many years ago, and I've walked into markets many times and nothing's happened. But this time, something happened, and I had this vision of this family, and that this store had once been the heart of the town, and now it was probably struggling, and what was all that about? So all those things collided in my head, and that first couple paragraphs that I read earlier came out of that. and they came out almost word for word as they are in the book now.
Amazing.
I moved that section when I was revising to different parts of the book, but it ended up at the beginning, and that's all I knew about Ella was what she told me in those first couple of paragraphs.
And you named the town Elbow.
I did.
Because it's on an oxbow of the Russian River.
That, and because there were so many Italian Americans there that they joked that it was named for Elbow Macaroni.
Macaroni.
Yes. But originally it was set in Occidental. Uh-huh. And then I had the wonderful opportunity to stay in a cabin on the Russian River near in Villa Grande area.
I don't know what Villa Grande
is. Villa Grande is part of Monterio, but it actually has its own separate post office. It's darling. There's a picture of it on my website, and we photoshopped Villa Grande out and put Elbow. But that little post office that's on my website is the one in Villa Grande. So I took Occidental. I wanted to make up the history. I wanted to have fun with the lobbing for coffins and some of that. So it was a mixture of the real history along with my made-up history. So that's where I decided I need a fictional town. Yeah. And I took part of Occidental and mushed it up into Villa Grande.
Well, it really
and
worked.
It came out Elbow.
Yeah. And I think the town and the countryside, the landscape, I think that's a character in your book.
Yes, it's, that's how I see it.
It's so important.
Thank you. Yes.
And I love what you wrote about the redwoods and how the daughters grow up around the mother tree. And you transmitted a lot of interesting information without being didactic. And that is such a difficult thing to pull off. Ella was trained in field biology, right?
Correct.
Yeah, and so she knew the proper names for the Latin names for everything. And
I know. I love that about her. I wish I had that trait.
But I love that you slipped in the names. I always like it when I'm reading something and it's pushing me a little towards something I don't know that much about.
I know. I like to learn when I read, too. And that took a lot of different revisions to get that right so that it didn't sound pulled out from a textbook or something like that. But, I love learning about those things, too. Mm-hmm. And it was funny because when they did the audio book, they asked me for all the pronunciations. And I said, I don't know them. Ella does, but she's not talking.
She's gardening. And right away in the book, we meet the children, Zach and Annie. And that little Annie is such a character. She had so much to say.
She's a smarty pants, Annie. Yes,
yes. She was. And then Zach,
she called Ella on her stuff sometimes.
Yep,
kids do.
Yeah. Zach was such a little sweetie.
Writing kids is tricky. They do say the darndest things and the cutest things. I wanted them to be real. They were real to me in my head, and I definitely borrowed. I mean, people have asked me, well, is it autobiographical? It's not. Ella's story is not my story at all. I had a completely different situation, but I did borrow some moments of motherhood for this book, definitely. And it was fun because when my kids read it, they recognized things as well. So I wanted to show the reality of what it's like to be a mom and a stepmom.
The dad doesn't stay in the story very long.
No, he doesn't.
But his presence is felt throughout this story, and the way she deals with her grief, and then when the children's mother shows up, Paige. I loved it that you made Paige a home stager. I only recently found out what a home stager was, so it was fun to come across it. Oh, she fixes up houses so they'll sell. And then she lived in Las Vegas. So you told a lot about Paige just from her setting.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, at first I didn't like her any more than Ella did when she first showed up. But as you got to know Paige and hear her story, then you had these two moms and the two children, and the story just bloomed from there about what would happen. And I wasn't sure what would happen until the very end. And that's always nice in a story.
That's another thing that's good to hear from the author's point of view.
Yes.
That you didn't know exactly what was going to happen. And,
Yeah. You
know, I think Ella was intimidated by Paige. And I was a bit intimidated by Paige, too,
yes.
when she walked on the page. I mean, she
was
flawlessly beautiful. And she's got
yes.
computer-enhanced hair and high heels that don't sink into the grass. And here she is. Calling Annie Sweet Pea. And so when she first came onto the page, for lack of a better word, I didn't like her either. Mm-hmm. And as I started to learn her story, I felt much more empathy mm-hmm. toward her. And I also know that we judge, you know,
we judge.
And we judge by appearance, we judge by what we've heard from other people.
Right.
And so Ella was definitely judging Paige, and I'm sure Paige was judging Ella as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so I won't, that's always a fun thing to dig your pen into.
Yeah. Another of the appealing things about your characters, they're not perfect.
No.
They have flaws.
Mm-hmm.
You present them as whole people with very admirable things and then some annoying little things that they do. And in some cases, some fairly serious flaws.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd a whole lot rather read about human beings than people who are perfect.
Yes, I know. And, you know, I think that was the thing that Ella felt a little bit about Paige. I mean, she was perfect on paper type of thing. And then you find out differently. But, you know, we mentioned Joe, the mm-hmm. father, who was not in most of the book, but he was there through all the other characters. They all had their stories and their feelings about Joe, and I think you could see what type of father he was to Annie and Zach just by who Annie and Zach were. And so I really admired that part about Joe.
Mm-hmm.
You knew how his parents felt about him, about how his brother felt about him, how Ella did, and finally Paige.
Mm-hmm.
Because I realized I had a problem with how I was going to present his character. But he really shaped the story, and without Joe, there probably wouldn't have been a story.
Yes.
There wouldn't have been. So I really liked getting to know these people. And they really did reveal themselves to me as I showed up each day. Mm-hmm. David came
his
into
brother,
the story, just
mm-hmm.
the brother, talking, and I loved him immediately. But I really didn't know his backstory until, numerous drafts.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was a family of secrets. Secrets are huge in this book.
There's a lot of secrets, but, you know, I think they are secrets of a different variety.
Yes.
There are the secrets of a family that doesn't talk about a topic because it's a taboo. Everyone knows it happened, but that's the taboo secret.
Yes,
then there's the secrets that we carry with us mm-hmm. since we were children, but we never give voice to them, but we know them in our heart, mm-hmm. in our mind, but we never speak them, that don't ever tell secrets. And then there's the secrets that we don't tell ourselves, the secrets, I guess, that probably wouldn't be secrets if we were brave enough to ask the questions,
mm-hmm.
but the I don't want to know secrets. Each of these secrets has a different type of weight. And I think, you know, secrets are, they're not all the created equal.
That's right.
But they all seem to create havoc in the soul. And that's what happens in this story.
When the family came into the story in your, I was going to say imagination, when the family began to reveal themselves, did you know at that point what their secrets would be?
I did not.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
Yes, yeah. I did not. I didn't know Ella's.
Yes.
Past when I started, I didn't know about the Italian internment. I'm not giving anything away, really, because this comes out during World War II. Italians in this area and the Bay Area were taken away to internment camps during World War II, and a lot of families don't talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And the government doesn't talk about it much.
Right.
And it wasn't just Italians, it was Germans. And we all know about Japanese Americans. It wasn't to the same degree as the Japanese Americans, not nearly, but it happened.
And in this family, it was devastating.
Yes.
And the shame that brought into the family and could not be discussed because it was shameful.
You know, shame and secrets go together so, you know, they're so interlinked.
Yeah.
And we all have shame in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And we all try to push it down and run away from it.
Mm-hmm.
And shame is such a part of both Ella's story, Paige's story, Joe's story.
Yes.
You know, shame is there. So when my friend Kelly, who's a history teacher here in Sonoma County, said to me when we were driving, "Do you know Italians in this area were interned during World War II?" My mouth dropped open. And I thought, that's why the Capozzis aren't talking about
that's
things.
That's why they act that way.
Yes, I really did. I mean, that's when you're writing, and you're not writing autobiographical at all,
right,
but the
right.
things that happen, the universe gives you these things, and
right.
it's that puzzle piece that was missing,
yes.
that thing that was missing. So I went and started researching, and I came across the book by Lawrence de Stasi called Una Storia Segreta, The Secret Story. And it's on the acknowledgement page of the book. It turns out that people aren't talking about it. It's a secret story.
Yes.
So, kind of fit in there. And then I had to write many drafts before I got the right weight to it because it was tempting to really go with that. So I had to get the balance right because I didn't want it to overtake what I was really exploring and the issues I was really exploring in the novel.
Yeah.
But I think the issue of shame and removing people, it just fit in with what was going on with this family and Paige and, mm-hmm. and everyone on a personal level.
Because that resonated through the story, and the reader isn't quite sure what's going on, but you know that there's something that hasn't yet been revealed.
Mm-hmm.
When the reader reaches the point where you reveal that, the reader said, "Now I get it. Now
mm-hmm.
I see why they were acting that way and why they were so inhibited and so reluctant to talk about that period of their lives."
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And, you know, that's fun for the reader to stumble upon the revelation
mm-hmm.
and have your curiosity and your interest rewarded by the good writing and the way that the author allows you to come to the secret yourself as a reader and doesn't signal too much ahead.
I think of it as dropping breadcrumbs
through
the story.
Yes,
and sometimes my breadcrumbs are too subtle and I need to go back and
mm-hmm.
and put a few more. And then other times they're a little heavy-handed, so I need to go back and until I feel like I have the right combination. And when you read a book a second time, sometimes you pick up on those breadcrumbs.
That's when you see the breadcrumbs.
That's why I like to reread also. That's the little hidden gifts for some readers that reread. But long live books. Long live them.
Books. Mm-hmm. And long live publishers.
Yes. Yes. This is a crazy time right now, isn't it?
And everyone says, it's impossible to get published. You know, nobody mm-hmm. will look at it. It's not impossible.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there's so many ways now. This the good thing. I mean, let's look at the bright side of things with the internet and everything that's happening that's scary for the publishing world. But it's also there are some positives. And you can get your work out there much more easily. Like my friend I mentioned, she self-published and then got the attention of New York by throwing herself a big launch party online, which hadn't been done when she did it. You know, there's also, I started a blog before I ever connected with my agent. And that was a stepping stone for me because I really hadn't had readers other than a handful of people that I shared my work with. It wasn't a blog where I said, "This is what I did today," but more of essays and stories.
Yes.
And it's called Who Moved My Buddha? And it was about change, which is another way of saying it's about life, right? So I was getting my work out there, not to a huge, huge audience, but a bigger audience than I had.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it, for lack of a better word, empowered me as a writer. Because I had been calling myself a writer and people would say, "Well, what do you write?" And mm-hmm. I'd say, "Oh, well, for a living, I write advertising and marketing, but I haven't gotten anyone to pay me yet for my fiction." That was my go-to line when people said, "Oh, what do you write? Have mm-hmm. I heard of you?"
Mm-hmm.
No. But I do have this blog if you want to check it out. You know, and some of my relatives had never really read my work.
Mm-hmm.
Other than, you know, eulogies for family members. And so I don't know. Things started happening for me after that. I don't know which came first or how it happened, but I think there are ways that you can get your work out there. and find your audience and keep writing and keep working and getting better and keep sending things out. The other thing about that's wonderful about the internet, it gives you so much information about agents. And there's a website called Publishers Marketplace. I think it's $23 a month or something. You can look up agents, see what kinds of books they write. You can look up a book you love, an author you love, see who their agent is, who their deal was, who their editor is, everything. So I really honed in on who my best picks for agents were. And this was not my first agent. You know, and 10 years ago, I didn't have, I wasn't able to match myself as well as I have this time. So the internet can be a great tool for writers. And it takes, you know, some research, which all writers are usually pretty good at.
Tell our readers again the name of that website that you used.
A Publisher's Marketplace is one.
Publisher's Marketplace.
The other thing is, you know, you can find an agent and then Google that agent. And up will come interviews and perhaps a blog that the agent writes. You can find out what type of cover letter that agent likes. My cover letter is on my agent's site right now as an example of something she was looking for that worked for her. I think my advertising background helped me a lot with my cover letter.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes. But, you know, it's not a mystery, I guess is what I want to say, like it once was or seemed to be to me. When I started querying agents, I was going to the mailbox, you know, and every day. And then when I was submitting things, no one wanted simultaneous submissions. So you would send it off to a literary magazine and wait, you know, 4, 5, 6 months to hear back. It was excruciatingly slow, and I blame that on why it all took me so long, partly. But, you know, I mean, timing, sometimes now I just think I had wanted this to happen so many years before. But the timing seems kind of perfect to me right now at this point in my life.
Yeah, things really came together for you.
It was worth waiting for.
But what you're saying, and we have a lot of writers who listen to this program too. What you're really saying is do your research.
It's a combination of things. And there, not that I know, I don't pretend to know the magical combination of how to make it happen. But I just know that there's so much information available online. Use that information. Get feedback from other writers. Don't give up. You know, the worst thing that can happen is that you spent your life doing something you absolutely love that fed your soul. And maybe your grandkids will read someday. It's not a bad thing to leave behind and not a bad way to live. And if it should happen that you do get your work out there and you find your audience, then you did it.
Yeah.
But you still did it.
Yes.
The process, and this is what I'm learning through all of this, that I already knew in my heart, it all comes down to the writing. That is why we do it. And it also helps keep me sane. I need to write, as dramatic as that sounds. I really do. And the writers that are listening understand that completely.
Of course.
So keep doing it. Don't stop.
It's been such a pleasure talking with you, Saree. And I wish you continued success. And I can't wait to read your next book.
Rosemary Manchester and Saree Prince Halverson. Saree's website is simple, SareePrinceHalverson.com. That's S-E-R-E, PrinceHalverson.com. You are listening to A Novel Idea from KRCB. Stay with us for my conversation with Sandy Baker on the Redwood Writers, and you won't want to miss Barbara Quick's reflection on Jeffrey Eugenides and his novel, The Marriage Plot. As Saree Prince Halverson stated in the first part of the show, writing may be a solitary act, but getting your work out there, and often just getting through your work, benefits from the support, the wisdom, and the generosity of other writers. I'm Suzanne Lang, and here is my conversation with Sandy Baker of the Redwood Writers and their upcoming conference. By the way, their motto is Writers Helping Writers. Welcome, Sandy.
Hey, thank you, Suzanne. I'm really glad to be here.
The Redwood Writers Conference is on April 28th, and of course there's the poetry night beforehand, April 27th, and we're going to talk about all this in just a minute. But first, Sandy, I want to talk a little bit about you and let our listeners know who you are, because you are not only the organizer of the conference, but you're a writer yourself.
Yes, I am a writer, and I have to say that it's really thanks to Redwood Writers that I became not only a writer, but a published author. So that's where it really helps to be a part of the organization. I've been writing for years, I think. I can't even remember when I started writing. It's just one of those things that I've always done.
You write some children's books or books for young adults?
I write for children approximately 5 to 9 years old. I'm also a master gardener. I've been in the master gardener program since 2000. And being a part of that program is what inspired my writing children's gardening books. I call them kid gardening books with a plot because they're not teachy-preachy. They're stories. They're picture books, fully illustrated picture books. And it's about getting kids involved in gardening, but they each have a plot.
So they're fun to read and kind of engaging in a backdoor way, huh?
Exactly. The kids probably don't know that they're actually reading a gardening book, but they are, and their parents and teachers love it too.
You have some things coming out fairly soon?
I do. This is going to be a crazy couple of months. At the beginning of March, I have an international thriller called The Turan Triangle that I co-authored with Tom Reed. And this is kind of a fun thing that he put together and invited me in to help him write it. And it's about a first-generation Iranian couple building a nuclear bomb down in El Paso, Texas. And it's very, very timely. We're practically writing in real time. And then in April, the beginning of April, I have my second kid gardening book coming out. This one is called Zach's Zany Zucchini Land. And it's kind of a cross between Jack and the Beanstalk and Little Shop of Horrors. And if you've ever planted zucchini, you'll know exactly what I mean.
Well, we'll look for those books then. And so you've just confessed that the Redwood Writers, your affiliation with them, helped nurture you personally as a writer. So tell us a little bit about what the conference has to offer writers.
Okay, it's really true, because I don't think without the conference that I attended in 2010 that I would be where I am today. And what I mean to tell is a story about how the conference can help writers, whether you're a brand new writer or even an experienced one. If you have written something and you think you have a book that's ready to go, if you go to the conference, you're going to get a lot of information about publishing, how to work with an agent, how to pitch to publishers, maybe even go with the non-traditional route and publish it yourself, turn it into an ebook. There's just so much information to absorb, and I think that conference back in 2010 is really what gave me the motivation to just keep writing and to figure it all out and to have my books published.
I've heard that again and again from writers who have attended the conference or some of the workshops that you put on, because you meet regularly.
Yes, we do. We meet every month, and we always have a really good speaker, whether the speaker talks about writing a series of books or writing a memoir or writing fiction or writing mystery or getting into marketing, learning about ebooks. The other thing about our monthly meetings is that you get to meet other writers and you get to network with them and you learn about their experiences. And I found that can sometimes be the most helpful thing, because if you think you're the only one out there floundering around and don't know where to go, you talk to other writers and you'll find that they've been there and done that, and they can give you just great direction and help about what to do and where to go.
Sonoma County is a very rich environment in just the way you're talking about, that people seem to celebrate each other's success, but also really are supportive of learning what you need to do.
That's true. It's really true. I think it's one of the things that makes Redwood Writers really successful. We don't hold back when it comes to support. We like to toot one's own horn and toot everybody else's horn too. We promote our own books and everybody else's books. And it makes us all kind of sisters and brothers in the organization. We're not competing. Our motto is, for Redwood Writers, writers helping writers. And that's really what we're all about. And I think people who are new to the organization will be amazed at how friendly everybody is and willing to help, not hold back, but to provide information. They don't want to be stingy with their information. We all want every other writer to succeed. So that's really what it's all about. And I've found that a most welcoming and embracing organization for that reason.
Now, the Redwood Writers is a branch of the California Writers Club, yes?
Correct, yes.
That was founded by Jack London.
Jack London was one of the original founders back in about 1912, I think it was.
So a rich heritage. The conference coming up in April, it's a one-day conference.
Yes, one-day conference.
And you don't have to be a member to attend the conference.
You don't have to be a member, and you don't have to be an experienced writer. This conference, I think, is going to be perfect for every level of writer or even wannabe writer.
Attending the conference is an exercise in choices, because you have a lot going on, and there are several different tracks that you can follow. I suppose you could stay with one track all day or bounce around a little bit, but why don't you talk a little bit about those different tracks?
I can hear the evaluations now. There were so many choices, and I missed out on those other ones that I wanted to take. This year we have four tracks. The tracks are craft, genre, publishing, and marketing. And each one of those tracks has four breakout sections. So that's a total of 16 choices. And in a one-day conference, the way we have it organized, you get four one-hour sessions. And you can choose all four sessions in a single track. Like if you really want to know about marketing, you've got your book, you've gotten it published, but you really want to know how to get it out there, you can take all four of your sessions in one track. Or you can mix and match, jump around. You can learn about how to build character in the craft track or in the genre track. You can learn how to write better historical fiction. Or in publishing, you can learn how to deal with an agent or a publisher, or learn about ebooks, or in marketing. Social media is so important these days. It's amazing. That's the vernacular that's coming out. Social media. Who knew about things like that years ago? About Googling and blogging and learning how to put yourself and your book out there. So it's really going to be an exercise in whittling down your choices to four. And I think regardless of what you choose, I think you're going to get a lot out of it. And regardless of what your level of experience is too.
Now in the morning, David Corbett is the keynote speaker. And at lunch, you have a panel. Tell us a little bit about David.
David, I actually was in a session of his back in 2010. And it turns out he was probably one of the most important and popular session presenters back then. Character is his specialty. And that's because he writes these great crime and mystery books with these really intriguing characters. And he knows how to develop character. He also knows how to help us to develop characters in a way that you just can't imagine. And he's very, very dynamic. He's going to be our keynote speaker, which is great. So he's going to start off the conference with his talk about a next step in publishing, going beyond the book. And then right after that, he's going to have his own breakout session about finding the character behind the character. And then jumping forward to lunchtime, this is a really high-powered panel that is going to talk about leaping into new ways of publishing. And I know that a lot of people are perhaps hesitant about the various modes of publishing these days. There's the traditional publishing, and there are many, many different kinds of independent publishing. And then, of course, there's the ebook publishing, and we're going to have Mark Coker from Smashwords back again. And we have had some very, very successful members publish the books through Smashwords. So it's going to be very, very exciting, I think. I can't wait.
It sounds like there's something for everyone. And also, every Redwood Writers Conference starts out really the night before with a poetry night.
Yes, yes. And I'm glad you mentioned that. Everyone loves poetry. We don't all understand it. We don't all write it. But even as a child, poetry is probably the first kind of literature that we ever were introduced to. So poetry has its own special night, always the night before the conference, the day-long conference on Saturday. So this poetry night, we have a special keynote speaker again, and that is Al Young, who is California Poet Laureate Emeritus. And the theme of poetry night is poetic journeys. But he will speak and he will also read some of his poetry. And I've never heard him, so I am really excited. I can't wait to hear him.
He's fun and compelling and has been a great supporter of poetry here in Sonoma County.
He has, and this is not his first time with Redwood Writers, so we're really thrilled to have him back again. And I would say, and I've heard this from others, that if you haven't heard him before, this is really the time to come on Friday night. It includes dinner. It's going to be a really nice program. And the awards for the poetry contest are going to be handed out that night, too. And those three poetry contest winners are also going to be reading their prize-winning poems. So that'll be fun.
And that is at the Flamingo Hotel on Friday night, April 27th. And the conference itself is over at the new Bertolini Student Center at the Junior College. That ought to be beautiful.
I think so. We have a lot of firsts in this conference. So, and going to the Bertolini Center, we've always had the conferences at the Flamingo Hotel just because it seemed to be convenient, but we thought we would try the Bertolini Center at the JC. So it's brick, it's glass, it's modern. We will have four different rooms that are going to be used for the breakout sessions. And I think it'll be a good trial for us, a good experiment. And everybody loves to go on to a college campus. So it's going to be fun. It's very convenient. It's on a Saturday. I don't think we'll be fighting for parking like you usually do during the week. So it ought to be very, very nice.
So how can people register to go to this conference that's going to be taking place in late April?
The best thing to do is go to the Redwood Writers website, and that is redwoodwriters.org, and click on the conference pages, and everything is going to be there. All the information, all the photos, the biographies of the speakers, descriptions of their talks, and the registration forms are there. And you can register by snail mail if you want, or you can register right online through PayPal, which is really convenient. And you don't have to have a PayPal account, which is nice. You can use any of your charge cards if you want. And for Redwood Writer members, the early bird registration ends on March 15th, and that's $120 for Redwood Writers. So if you're into procrastination and it's worth $30, fine. But I would say for both members and non-members, the rates are less expensive if you register before March 15th. So that would be a good thing to do. And you can register for Poetry Night at the same night, too. So it's all in one. You can go to both events or one or the other and do it all online.
Well, thank you, Sandy Baker. We look forward to seeing you there. Go out to the website, redwoodwriters.org, and register to go to the conference. Poetry Night is April 27th, and the conference is Saturday, April 28th in Santa Rosa. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you, Suzanne. We'll see you there.
And finally today, on A Novel Idea, author and screenwriter Barbara Quick brings us her commentary on Jeffrey Eugenides' latest novel, The Marriage Plot.
Must one have a penis to win the Pulitzer Prize in fiction? Given that 41 out of the last 58 winners have been men, I'd say not necessarily, but it will certainly increase your chances. Jeffrey Eugenides, who gained accolades and a movie sale for his first novel, The Virgin Suicides, was awarded the Pulitzer for his 2003 novel, Middlesex, which concerned the possession of a penis and was excerpted so intriguingly in The New Yorker. His 2011 novel, The Marriage Plot, has had a marketing push worthy of the Second Coming, including a much larger-than-life depiction of the author on a billboard above Times Square with the headline, "Swoonworthy," hovering over him. The image has been described as a nerdy version of the Marlboro Man or Indiana Jones with a seriously receded hairline. Okay, I'm all for publishers shelling out money to support the sale of novels. A huge yes to that from me. But this is truly a 1% situation. The other 99% of novelists, in these lean and mean days of publishing, are expected to sink or swim solely through their own efforts and expenditure, blogging till they're blue in the face and underwriting their own book tours. Their publishers don't pay for ads, to say nothing of billboards. Jonathan Franzen has been given similar star treatment, including the cover of Time magazine, as has the late David Foster Wallace, who was part of the same friendly and competitive cohort of Midwestern novelists that includes Franzen and Eugenides. Wallace, who suffered from clinical depression as well as the usual professional insecurities, one-upped his up-and-coming friends by committing suicide in 2008 and thus assuring his place in the literary pantheon. Or perhaps not. In 1944, the critic Edmund Wilson wrote that the most striking thing about the generation of writers that included F. Scott Fitzgerald and Ernest Hemingway was its failure to reach full development. The best writers of the 1920s, he wrote, were canonized too soon. Men of still maturing abilities, on the verge of more important things, have turned up suddenly in the role of old masters with the best of their achievement behind them. I suspect that Franzen and Eugenides would both cringe with recognition of the relevance of this assessment if applied to their own prematurely stellar careers. Don't get me wrong, The Marriage Plot is not a bad novel. Eugenides is obviously very intelligent and very well-read. He has an urge toward goodness, and he writes with skill. But his descriptions of place seem like movie sets rather than windows onto a living, breathing world. He gives us smugness where we long for something more nuanced and mysterious. And he doesn't dig deeply enough for his main characters, three recent graduates of Brown University enmeshed in a very conventional love triangle. The heroine, an upper-crust literature major named Madeline, is just one step above cardboard. One of the two guys in love with her is clearly based on Eugenides himself, trying to make peace with his own nerdiness. Madeline's other boyfriend, later husband, is an overly researched, exhaustively described, and ultimately obnoxious genius in the mold of David Foster Wallace. The character modeled on the author is the most interesting of the three. The novel is all about Mitchell, the Eugenides stand-in, trying to feel good about himself. I think Madeline's characterization is so shallow because Mitchell needs to feel okay at the end about Madeline's rejection of him. If she's not all that great and really not all that interesting, well then, it's no great loss for Mitchell and he can go on to better things. A Pulitzer Prize, anyone? In the end, all three characters seem tiresome rather than tragic, hopelessly self-absorbed, and somehow unconvincing in their humanity. Try as I might to care about them, I simply couldn't. There were all too many passages where it seemed that Eugenides was simply showing off how well-read he is. One could cull a terrific reading list for a great books curriculum from the works referenced in the pages of this novel. No, alas, Geoffrey Eugenides is not another Tolstoy, any more than his friend Jonathan Franzen. Nor is The Marriage Plot a great novel, despite the flood tide of money and hype. But I think what is happening with these writers reveals something profound about the literary world in 21st century America. We are wrestling with that old fear that the greatest artistic achievements of our civilization are behind us. It is too painful to think that there may never be another writer with the genius and humanity of Tolstoy. And so we hopefully and hysterically anoint new Tolstoy wannabes every 10 years or so. I believe that the writer's job is to do his or her best work and to leave it to posterity to judge whether the work will withstand the test of time. To quote Jonathan Franzen's speech at David Foster Wallace's memorial, it is the writer's job to give love, not just create from the part that wants to be loved. Which gets me back to the subject of penises and the Pulitzer Prize. The entertainment industry, which now includes the literary establishment, is in the business of trying to suss out what people long for. What we want, it would seem, is the literary equivalent of comfort food, as retro as Mad Men or the cover of The Marriage Plot, which harkens graphically back to a more confident and hopeful time for America. This is a particularly difficult time to be a writer or an artist of any kind, to feel comfortable taking risks, to write what comes from the deepest places inside us without reference to what we are told will sell. It's a really tricky thing for even the best, most talented writers to live in a society where literary worth is based on size. Of one's advance, the font used for one's name on the cover, the ad in the New York Times Book Review, and now the billboard above Times Square. Size, I guess, really does matter. I'm Barbara Quick for A Novel Idea.
Visit Barbara Quick at www.asktherwriter.blogspot.com. Thanks for listening. This has been A Novel Idea.
Thank all of you for joining us.
I'm Suzanne Lang.
And I'm Rosemary Manchester.
You can listen and subscribe to our podcasts at krcb.org. www.kcrcb.org.
And remember, there's no such thing as too many books.